Did you know Microsoft has officially ended support for Windows 10? Upgrade to Windows 11 with an LG Gram laptop. Voted PC Mag's Reader's Choice Top Laptop Brand for 2025. Thin and ultra lightweight, the LG Gram keeps you productive anywhere. And Windows 11 gives you access to free security updates and ongoing feature upgrades. Visit lgusa.com/iHeart for great seasonal savings on LG Gram laptops with Windows 11. PC Mag Reader's Choice used with permission. All rights reserved.
The man known to history as King Edward VII of the United Kingdom was born in Buckingham Palace in London on the 9th of November 1841. As the first-born son of Queen Victoria of the United Kingdom, he was heir to the British throne. His mother, the 22-year-old Queen Victoria, had been on the British throne since 1837, following the death of her uncle, King William IV. At the time of her birth in 1819, near the end of the reign of her grandfather, George III, Princess Victoria had been fifth in the line of succession, but the death of her father, Edward, Duke of Kent and Strathearn, as well as her three childless uncles, placed her on the throne at the age of 18. She would remain as queen for more than 60 years, during which her heir became increasingly impatient about his chance to become king. The young prince's father and namesake was Prince Albert of Saxe-Coburg-Gotha, a German prince and Victoria's cousin. The couple were engaged in 1837, but did not marry until the 10th of February 1840, with Albert taking the title of Prince Consort. Albert would become a close political advisor and loving husband, and the couple would have 9 children between 1840 and 1857. The eldest, Princess Victoria, was born in November 1840, less than a year before the birth of Albert Edward, who was named after his father and maternal grandfather. Edward's birth was enthusiastically welcomed all over the country, and on the 25th of January 1842, the boy was baptized by the Archbishop of Canterbury at St. George's Chapel in Windsor Castle and given the name Prince Albert Edward. As the eldest son of the British monarch, he held the titles of Duke of Cornwall and Duke of Rothesay from birth and was given the title of Prince of Wales a month later, on the 8th of December. Albert Edward, known as Bertie to the family, grew up during a time when the British Empire was reaching its greatest heights. The United Kingdom was the first country to experience the Industrial Revolution, as the invention of new manufacturing processes and the specialization of labor enabled the economy to grow at a rapid rate. Following the end of the Napoleonic Wars in 1815, Britain had defeated France in the struggle to become the dominant global superpower, controlling the trade routes through the Royal Navy. In addition to the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland, the British Empire's territories included Canada, the Indian subcontinent, parts of Southern Africa, Australia, and New Zealand, while British economic power meant that its influence stretched far beyond its formal imperial boundaries. The United Kingdom was one of few countries to have a constitutional monarchy where political power was shared between the monarch and Parliament. Consisting of the House of Lords, representing the aristocracy and the church, and the House of Commons, representing the country's business and mercantile interests. Since the Civil War in the 17th century and the Glorious Revolution of 1689, the powers of the monarch had gradually diminished over the countries, and the executive power of the sovereign was devolved to the Prime Minister and his cabinet, which introduced government legislation and steered it through Parliament. While parliamentary legislation still had to receive royal assent, this was increasingly a formality, and the monarch was reduced to serving as a source of advice to the government. As a future king, the young Bertie followed a program of education designed to teach him the duties of being a constitutional monarch which was devised by his father in 1847. Although the child proved to be charming and likable, he was inattentive and struggled in his studies, especially when compared to his older sister Victoria, whose abilities surpassed those of her age. The Prince of Wales' shortcomings simply prompted his parents to apply stricter disciplinary measures, and in April 1849, Bertie's education was entrusted to Henry Birch of Eton College, who described the young prince as extremely disobedient, impertinent to his masters, and unwilling to submit to discipline. With a short attention span and a tendency to lose his temper easily, especially when he was teased. Despite this, he was subject to frequent teasing and mockery from his tutor in the best traditions of the British public school. Nevertheless, Bertie had grown fond of Birch and was sad to see him quit his post of tutor in 1852 when he was ordained as a priest, and the departing tutor was also sorry to leave his young charge. The prince was much less fond of his replacement, a lawyer and Cambridge fellow called Frederick Weymouth Gibbs, who made his frustrations clear in his reports to the Queen and Prince Consort. The course of instruction was intense, with lessons beginning at 8 in the morning and ending at 7 in the evening. Some of Bertie's tutors, including his German tutor and Albert's librarian, Dr. Becker, and his religious instructor, the Reverend Gerald Wellesley, younger brother to the late Duke of Wellington, believed that the prince's studies were too exacting and proposed a lightening of the load. But this suggestion was rejected by Victoria and Albert, who believed that the only remedy to Bertie's behaviour was physical discipline. The young prince's tendency for violent outbursts led to fears that he had inherited the condition of his great-grandfather, George III, who had experienced multiple bouts of insanity during his life. Although Victoria had hoped to bring up her son in the image of his father, Prince Albert's strict approach to parenting and his efforts to keep Bertie isolated from boys of his age caused the latter to be afraid of him. Bertie was consciously aware that he did not live up to the expectations of his father, although he enjoyed hunting, watching operatic and theatrical performances, and appearing at public events such as military reviews and ceremonies alongside the Queen in his capacity as Prince of Wales. Keen to escape the walls of Buckingham Palace, he enjoyed his first foreign trip to visit his great-uncle King Leopold in Belgium, but he was particularly charmed by the attractions of Paris when, at the age of 13, he accompanied his parents on a state visit to Emperor Napoleon III in August 1855. Bertie's isolation further increased when he was separated from his younger brother Alfred, with whom he had shared many childhood lessons, and in 1858 he bid farewell to his dear sister Princess Victoria, who had married Crown Prince Frederick William of Prussia and was joining him in Potsdam. In the same year, Queen Victoria recognised that Gibbs' approach was not working, and Bertie was given more independence and a new allowance of £500 a year, most of which he spent on clothes, further exasperating his parents. Alongside his newfound independence, the prince was granted his wish to join the army, and was appointed.
Did you know Microsoft has officially ended support for Windows 10? Upgrade to Windows 11 with an LG Gram laptop. Voted PC Mag's Reader's Choice Top Laptop Brand for 2025. Thin and ultra lightweight, the LG Gram keeps you productive anywhere. And Windows 11 gives you access to free security updates and ongoing feature upgrades. Visit lgusa.com/iHeart for great seasonal savings on LG Gram laptops with Windows 11. PC Mag Reader's Choice used with permission. All rights reserved.
Appointed to the rank of Lieutenant Colonel, but was disappointed that he had not been allowed to take the usual examinations, as Victoria and Albert feared the embarrassment of him not passing. Moreover, his new governor, Colonel Robert Bruce, had instructions to maintain a close watch over him, a sign that his parents still did not trust the 17-year-old prince to look after his own affairs properly. Even when Bertie was sent to Christ Church College, Oxford, in October 1858, a month shy of his 18th birthday, Prince Albert ensured that Bruce, now promoted to Major General, would continue to supervise his movements. For all his shortcomings, Bertie had performed admirably in his exams in Oxford, winning rare praise from his parents. Victoria and Albert's faith in their son's abilities was further boosted by the prince's tour of Canada in July 1860, being the first heir to the British throne to make a transatlantic journey. He was enthusiastically welcomed everywhere he went, landing in Newfoundland and proceeding up the St. Lawrence River to Hamilton via Montreal, Ottawa, and Toronto. On the 20th of September, he crossed the border into the United States for a month-long tour where he proved equally popular, drawing a crowd of 300,000 people in New York. In Washington, he met President James Buchanan and was taken to see George Washington's house and grave at Mount Vernon and had the opportunity to attend a parade at West Point alongside General Winfield Scott. The tour was a resounding success, and Bertie's conduct was met with widespread approval from both his parents, who no longer considered him a lost cause. The prince had hoped that he would be allowed to join the army following his return from his transatlantic tour, but was instead transferred to Trinity College, Cambridge, to continue his studies. He particularly enjoyed lectures from Charles Kingsley, the new Regius Professor of Modern History, with whom he had interesting discussions on contemporary politics. In the summer of 1861, the Prince of Wales was finally given the opportunity to fulfill his ambitions of receiving military instruction, but his excitement was tempered by the exacting 10-week training regime he had to undertake with the Grenadier Guards at the Curran military camp near Dublin, during which he was expected to carry out the duties of a lowly ensign at the beginning and to have the ability to command a battalion by the end. Such a demanding course of instruction proved too much for Bertie, and when his parents visited Curran on the 23rd of August in the company of the Duke of Cambridge, the Queen's cousin and commander-in-chief, all three came to the conclusion that the prince was not fit to be a soldier. Life in the military camp did have its consolations when the prince's friends smuggled the young actress Nellie Clifton into his room. The prince enjoyed her company and had seemingly fallen in love with her, continuing to see her as often as he could after his return to England, which undermined his parents' efforts to find him a suitable wife. Victoria and Albert cast their eyes over the royal houses of Europe for a princess who would one day become Queen of the United Kingdom, and after an exhaustive search, they decided on the 17-year-old Princess Alexandra of Denmark, the daughter of Prince Christian, heir to the Danish throne. The two met in September 1861 in Speyer Cathedral in Germany, under the auspices of Bertie's sister and brother-in-law, Crown Princess Victoria and Crown Prince Frederick William. Although the prince found the Danish princess charming, he appeared unenthusiastic about the prospect of marriage, and it was only when Prince Albert learned of his son's affair with Nellie Clifton that the severity of the situation became clear. After informing the Queen, the Prince Consort wrote his son a lengthy rebuke, speculating about the damaging public scandal that would arise should the young girl give birth to the Prince's child, prompting Bertie to acknowledge his guilt and regret over the affair and to commit to marrying Princess Alexandra as soon as possible. Albert's health had been gradually declining, and when he visited Bertie in Cambridge at the end of November, the stress of the situation may have worsened the Prince Consort's illness. Late on the 14th of December, Prince Albert died of an illness diagnosed by contemporaries as typhoid fever, leaving the Queen distraught and in mourning for her remaining 40 years. Despite the Prince of Wales' best efforts to console his mother, Queen Victoria was convinced that her eldest son's scandalous behaviour had been the cause of her beloved Albert's death and relations between mother and son remained forever strained as a result. The late Prince Albert had envisaged a tour of the Middle East as the final stage of his son's program of education, and Bertie embarked on the trip in January 1862, arriving at Alexandria in Egypt on the 1st of March, going up and down the Nile before proceeding on to the Holy Land and arriving at Damascus at the end of April. Like his previous tours abroad, the prince did not seem particularly interested in sightseeing or learning about the millennia of history witnessed by the stones of the temples and churches he visited, but was more comfortable exchanging pleasantries with his hosts and going on hunting trips. By late May, he was in Constantinople, where he met the Ottoman Sultan, making his way home via Greece and France. On the whole, the tour proved another success and helped to improve the prince's relationship with his mother, but it was, however, marred by the death of General Bruce, who had contracted a fever when abroad and died soon after his return to England. Both the Queen and the Prince of Wales were keen on moving forward with the wedding with Princess Alexandra, and accordingly, the engagement was announced in September 1862, and the couple were married on the 10th of March 1863 at St. George's Chapel in Windsor. Although Queen Victoria was very fond of her daughter-in-law, the occasion proved bittersweet, coming so soon after Albert's death, and when she sat for a photograph with the newlywed couple, her eyes were instead fixed upon a bust of her late husband. Bertie and Alex, as Princess Alexandra was nicknamed in the British royal family, spent their time between Marlborough House in London on Pall Mall, round the corner from St. James's Palace, and the country estate of Sandringham House in Norfolk, which the prince had bought in 1862. The princess was charmed by the estate, that was set in flat terrain which reminded her of her Danish homeland, but other visitors were known to complain about the barren landscape and lack of activities in the area. Nevertheless, the prince and princess made it a tradition to stay at Sandringham for their birthdays on the 9th of November and 1st of December respectively, as well as for the Christmas holidays. Even as he settled into married life with Princess Alexandra, the Queen could not help but continue to express her anxieties about her son and the company he kept, believing that it was harmful to her beloved daughter-in-law. She was particularly concerned about Bertie's association with the beautiful and vivacious Duchess of Manchester, who had taken on a string of lovers, including Bertie's close friend Lord Hartington, later Duke of Devonshire, whom she eventually married upon the death of her husband. The Queen was also concerned about her son's influence in London society, where he was the patron of the Garrick Club, frequented by actors and actresses. Victoria believed that by keeping such company, the Prince of Wales risked the dignity of the crown and associated her son's behaviour with what she saw as a decline in the moral values of the British aristocracy. The Queen's negative opinion of her son's character prompted her to exclude him from any position of power or authority. She restricted his access to important state papers and did not allow him to act as her representative in public. The Queen was justified in her worries over her son's indiscretion on political matters, which revealed itself in 1864 when German armies led by Prussia and Austria invaded Denmark to exercise a dynastic claim to the duchies of Schleswig and Holstein. While the Prince of Wales was naturally and openly sympathetic towards his father-in-law, now King Christian IX of Denmark, Queen Victoria quietly favoured the German claim and criticised her son for his pro-Danish views, even though they were shared by the public. Not for the first time in British history, the heir to the throne was undermining official government policy, going as far as discussing his objections with the leaders of the liberal opposition. When the Italian revolutionary General Giuseppe Garibaldi visited the United Kingdom, hoping to rally English support for the Danish cause, he received an enthusiastic reception at his public appearances. Garibaldi was staying at Stafford House, the home of the prince's close friend, the Duke of Sutherland, and the prince made sure to call on his friend while the Italian hero was present. The meeting prompted a severe rebuke from the queen, who was appalled at the idea that the heir to a crown could so brazenly meet an avowed revolutionary. But the prince refused to apologize and considered the meeting a success. Not only had Victoria been running out of patience with her son, but she was also in the process of doing so with her daughter-in-law. In December 1863, Alex had given birth to a son named Albert Victor by the Queen, despite the objections of the child's parents. The Queen believed that the princess was being worn out by the active lifestyle the couple continued to lead after the birth of their son, and she was unable to stop the couple from visiting the princess's Danish relatives in September 1864, despite the diplomatic difficulties with the German states, whose armies had seized control of Schleswig and Holstein. When Alex gave birth to her second child, Prince George, on the 3rd of June 1865, Victoria repeated her complaints, but within a year, the princess was pregnant once again, preventing her from going to Russia to attend the wedding of her sister Dagmar to Grand Duke Alexander, the son and heir of Tsar Alexander II. The Prince of Wales went without her and thoroughly enjoyed his time in St. Petersburg and Moscow, temporarily improving relations between Britain and Russia, whose imperial ambitions were colliding in Central Asia. Upon his return from Russia, the prince discovered that his wife was ill, suffering pains in her limbs which were exacerbated by the birth of Princess Louise on the 20th of February 1867. Bertie appears to have made light of his wife's serious health condition, continuing to go out most evenings and feeling bored when obliged to spend time at her bedside. Alex's health gradually improved in the coming months, but she was still confined to a wheelchair by July, and she would walk with a limp for the rest of her life. Bertie's neglect of his wife proved even more hurtful following rumours that the prince had taken a liking to certain young ladies during his time in Russia and often found himself in female company during a visit to France to attend the opening of the Paris exhibition in April 1867. When Alex was well enough to travel to Wiesbaden in Germany to take the waters, she caused a diplomatic incident by refusing to meet with King Wilhelm of Prussia, whom she blamed for the devastation of her homeland. It was up to Bertie to apologize for his wife and to meet the King and Queen of Prussia alone. But when this did not satisfy the parties involved, the prince forced a meeting with the king upon his reluctant wife, which went far more cordially than anyone had the right to expect. Queen Victoria was not amused during the whole scandal and became convinced that both her son and daughter-in-law were unfit to occupy the royal offices that they would one day inherit. By his 20s, the Prince of Wales had developed a reputation as a prince of pleasure. He hated being idle and attended horse races and hunts throughout the country, frequented banquets and balls in London, visited musical and theatrical establishments, and was once seen dancing the can-can with the Duchess of Manchester in a nightclub. Every year, the prince would make several visits abroad, including brief visits to Paris without his wife. Even at home in Marlborough House or Sandringham, the prince enjoyed entertaining male friends, playing cards, billiards, or making use of the bowling alleys that had been specially installed in both his houses, while the women were invited to dance with the prince. These entertainments, the costs of refurbishing and expanding the house at Sandringham, combined with his fondness for gambling modest sums, put pressure on the prince's finances. In spite of this, in the autumn of 1868, soon after Alex gave birth to her daughter Victoria, the prince and princess embarked on an expensive 7-month-long holiday through Germany and Austria to Egypt, Turkey, Crimea, and back via Greece, Italy, and France. For most of his life, the Prince of Wales had been extremely popular among the British public, but a scandal which broke in the spring of 1869 considerably undermined his popularity. The case involved the 21-year-old Lady Harriet Mordaunt, the wife of Liberal MP Sir Charles Mordaunt, who had been an occasional guest at the Prince's parties. After the birth of her first child, Lady Harriet began to act eccentrically, when it was feared that her daughter might be blind, which she attributed to venereal disease. She admitted to her husband that she had committed adultery on several occasions, including with the Prince of Wales, a claim that was supported by Sir Charles's discovery of letters from the Prince to his wife in a drawer, prompting him to ask for a divorce. The Prince pleaded innocence and was supported by his family, including the Queen, and confidently denied that he had acted improperly with Lady Harriet when he was obliged to give evidence in court on the 23rd of February 1870. Although the case was dismissed on the grounds that Lady Harriet was declared insane and confined to a lunatic asylum, the British public continued to believe that the Prince had been unfaithful, causing great damage to the reputation of the monarchy and leading to calls for a republic. There was considerable public sympathy for Princess Alexandra, who had given birth to her fifth child, Princess Maud, in November 1869. Supporters of the monarchy agreed that the Prince of Wales may have avoided such a delinquent lifestyle if he had been given greater responsibilities by his mother, and even in his late 20s, his royal duties remained relatively minor. The Prince offered to carry out diplomatic duties, but both the Queen and her government considered this to be improper in light of his tendency to be indiscreet. When France and Prussia went to war in July 1870, his sympathies had lain towards France, but he offered to mediate between Paris and Berlin. These offers were never taken seriously, and the decisive Prussian victory at the Battle of Sedan on the 1st and 2nd of September 1870, during which the Emperor Napoleon III fell into Prussian captivity, ensured that the conflict would end in Prussia's favour, the final stepping stone to the unification of the Empire of Germany. The royal family's fortunes were only revived by the Prince of Wales suffering a near-death experience in late 1871 after catching typhoid fever, the same disease which was said to have claimed the life of his father. By early December, it was feared he would not survive, and the Queen and members of the royal family were summoned to his bedside. But on the 15th of December, the Prince began a slow recovery, with his wife constantly at his side. The Prime Minister, William Gladstone, arranged a ceremony of public thanksgiving for the Prince's recovery at St. Paul's Cathedral to take place on the 27th of February 1872, which resulted in a public outpouring of affection for the Queen and the Prince of Wales as they rode in an open carriage. After the Prince had made his full recovery, the government decided that it was time for him to play a more active public role. Although the Prince would have preferred a career in the army, the Queen believed that her son was not capable of exercising the order and discipline required for a serving army officer. While proposals by ministers to give the Prince a position in the government of India or Ireland were also vetoed. Meanwhile, the Prince once again demonstrated his unsuitability for any diplomatic role upon a visit to France in the summer of 1872, during which he met Adolphe Thiers, the president of the newly established French Third Republic. The meeting was a further demonstration to the Germans of the Prince's pro-French sympathies, but the Prince also attracted criticism from French Republicans by meeting with former aristocrats and supporters of the deposed Napoleon III, who would die in English exile on the 9th of January, 1873. Frustrated by his lack of responsibilities, the prince planned a tour of India for 1875 without informing neither the government, his mother, the queen, nor his wife. While Victoria reluctantly gave her consent, the proposed costs of the trip were expected to be borne by the government and, by extension, the British public, leading to a series of public demonstrations against the Prince of Wales, whose reputation had not recovered fully from the Mordaunt affair. Meanwhile, Alix protested that she was to be left behind in England, refusing to accept Bertie's explanations that her presence would have complicated diplomatic protocol with the Indian princes. The prince left England on the 26th of September and arrived at Bombay on the 8th of November, the eve of his 34th birthday. Despite fears that the prince might receive a cold welcome and even be a target for assassination, The Times newspaper reported a few days later that from the moment the prince set foot on the shores of India, there has been one continuous demonstration surpassing all that could be expected or imagined. Over the next 5 months, the prince travelled all over the Indian subcontinent, including Goa, the island of Ceylon, now Sri Lanka, Madras, now Chennai, and Calcutta before the end of the year, and moving north in the new year to Delhi, Lahore, Agra, Jaipur, and going as far as Nepal. During the course of his travels, he reviewed troops of the colonial army, visited economic enterprises producing and processing the goods which fueled the wealth of the British Empire, and attended numerous banquets and other celebrations in his honour. As always, his charming manner worked its magic with Indians of all social classes, although his tendency to dance with the most attractive women, rather than those of the highest rank, caused some offence to a few of his Indian hosts. When the prince left Bombay on the 13th of March, he took with him expensive gifts from his hosts, as well as a large collection of hunting trophies he had bagged during the trip, including several leopards, tigers, elephants, antelopes, ostriches, a Himalayan bear, and a cheetah. The tour was seen as a universal success which strengthened the British monarchy in India, and upon his return, the prince told the queen that Indian affection for the British would be further bolstered if they were not treated so dismissively by British officials. And following this report, the Queen issued instructions to improve the conduct of officials in India. While the Prince had been on his way back to England, Parliament bestowed the title of Empress of India upon the Queen, which she gratefully accepted. But the Prince of Wales was disappointed not to be consulted on the issue, which saw his mother elevated to a rank much higher than his own. Throughout his life, the prince had enjoyed the company of other ladies, and Princess Alexandra learned to overlook these dalliances in the knowledge that she never lost her husband's affection. In May 1877, a year after his return from India, the prince met the 24-year-old beauty Lily Langtry for the first time, and by the end of the year, the pair began a lengthy affair, helped along by the prince inviting her to the country houses where he was due to stay for the weekend. The romantic liaison lasted until 1880, as Langtry started taking other lovers, but the prince remained fond of her, and it was thanks to his influence that she launched into a successful career as a theatrical actress in 1881. By this point, the prince had transferred his attention to Lady Daisy Brooke, later the Countess of Warwick, engaging in an affair lasting well into the 1890s. The liaison ended when the prince grew bored of the lectures of a woman who had become an ardent socialist and attempted to persuade him to do more to improve the condition of the working classes. After the success of the India tour, the prince was even more frustrated at his lack of responsibilities in England. He made brief speeches in the House of Lords in his capacity as Duke of Cornwall, including one impassioned speech in favour of housing reform after an incognito visit to the slums of East London revealed the appalling poverty that affected many Londoners. In May 1880, he finally had his wish of a military appointment granted when he was made Colonel-in-Chief of the Household Cavalry. But the prince's desire to be sent out to Egypt in 1882 to join the forces quelling a nationalist revolt was opposed by the Queen and her ministers, who did not consider it wise to expose him to such dangers. As a result, the prince was reduced to hosting dinners honouring senior military officers who had been on campaign. Meanwhile, he was still denied access to important political and diplomatic documents. Though Benjamin Disraeli, the Queen's favourite prime minister, was known to pass on some information without telling the monarch. It was not until 1892, when the Prince of Wales was 51, that he was given access to state documents. Although he was not trusted with political matters, the Prince of Wales did prove an effective organiser of ceremonial events, such as Queen Victoria's Golden Jubilee in 1887, for which he was in charge of the diplomatic protocol regulating the behaviour of foreign guests. He was also placed in charge of the arrangements for the Colonies and India Exhibition the same year. Several years earlier, in 1883, he helped to found the Royal College of Music and served as chairman of the Executive Council, and his patronage helped to develop the institution as the premier venue for the training of professional musicians. As the Queen approached her final years in the 1890s, the Prince was given more opportunities to deputise for her, though this was largely as a consequence of the death or retirement of individuals who had previously performed these duties. In 1891, the prince found himself embroiled in yet another public scandal, which again undermined his popularity among the wider public. In September 1890, he was a guest at Tranby Court, the Yorkshire home of shipping magnate Arthur Wilson. While the prince and his friends were playing the card game Baccarat, two of the guests suspected that Sir William Gordon Cumming, an officer in the Scots Guards and a friend of the prince, had been cheating by surreptitiously adding to his stake. When the party returned to the card table the following day, Gordon Cumming's behaviour continued to be suspicious, and the prince and his advisors were also persuaded that cheating had taken place. Those present pressured Gordon Cumming into signing a document in which he agreed that he would no longer play cards again and the guests would stay quiet about the whole affair. The secret nevertheless leaked, and Gordon Cumming brought a lawsuit against his accusers, including the prince, whose efforts to have the case heard in a military rather than a public civil court were in vain. The Solicitor General, Sir Edward Clarke, representing Gordon Cumming, managed to highlight inconsistencies in the accusers' statements, winning considerable public sympathy in the process. But the jury eventually decided that Gordon Cumming had indeed cheated. Although cleared once again, the affair dented the prince's popularity in the short term, confirming his reputation as a wastrel and gambler. Throughout his life, the Prince of Wales had associated himself with friends and acquaintances whom the Queen and other leading aristocrats had disapproved of. While many of these were indeed individuals of ill repute, the prince's friendships with prominent Jewish individuals and families was also controversial during a time of heightened anti-Semitism. The British aristocracy owed its wealth to land and was dismissive of those who came into money through business and finance. But the Prince of Wales was fascinated by economics and the capitalist system. He was a frequent guest of the Sassoons, a rich merchant family with extensive commercial operations in India, and was as friendly with the famous Rothschild banking family, having known Nathaniel Mayer Rothschild at Cambridge and been treated to entertainment at their vast estates throughout the country. The prince's limited income and his extravagant lifestyle led him to borrow money not only from the Rothschilds, but from other prominent Jewish financiers, including Sir Ernest Cassel, a German-born banker who became one of the wealthiest men in the country and was a financial backer of the Aswan Dam in Egypt, completed in 1902. In 1892, the Prince and Princess of Wales suffered a great tragedy with the death of their eldest son, Prince Albert Victor, Duke of Clarence and Avondale, known to his parents as Prince Eddie. Like his father, Eddie was a poor student who was nevertheless blessed with charm and kindness. He spent his childhood and education alongside his younger brother George, and when they were 13 and 12 respectively, they were sent for naval training as cadets on the ship Britannia, where George performed much better. The Prince of Wales was experiencing the same headaches over what to do with an eldest son who failed to live up to expectations as his father, Prince Albert, had over his own upbringing. In his mid-20s, the handsome Prince Eddie began attracting the attentions of women, and in 1890 he fell in love with Princess Hélène of Orléans, who was not only a Roman Catholic, but the daughter of the pretender to the French throne. Such a match would, therefore, cause both religious and diplomatic issues, and despite both the Queen and Prince of Wales being in favour of the match, provided that the prospective bride convert to the Church of England, the proposal was rejected by her father, and the prospect of her conversion was also rejected by the Pope. With the French princess out of the picture, Princess Mary of Teck emerged as an alternative candidate, and the wedding was fixed for February 1892. It would never take place, as Prince Eddie fell seriously ill from pneumonia in December 1891 and died at Sandringham on the 14th of January 1892, days after his 28th birthday. His younger brother George would later marry the bereaved fiancée. Although devastated by the loss of his eldest son, the Prince of Wales could be consoled by the fact that it was now his far more able brother George who would become the heir to the throne. This prospect came closer with every passing year as Queen Victoria's health gradually declined. In 1897, she celebrated her Diamond Jubilee and remained in fine spirits for her 80th birthday a couple of years later, but eventually breathed her last on the 22nd of January 1901, after almost 64 years on the throne. Prince Albert Edward, after a 59-year wait, was finally king. The death of such a long reigning monarch and the accession of a king whose personal life had caused public scandal on more than one occasion naturally called into question the stability of the British monarchy. In spite of these fears, the new king's popularity was little in doubt. Contrary to his mother's wishes for him to reign as King Albert Edward, he instead chose the designation Edward VII, arguing that it was a finer tribute for his father to be the only sovereign or consort named Albert. Despite his earlier objections to the circumstances in which his mother received her imperial title, the new king was happy to assume the title of Emperor of India. As if in protest against his late mother's inclinations to deny him powers and responsibilities, as soon as he moved into Buckingham Palace and Windsor Castle, he ordered the reorganization and redecoration of her favorite rooms and the clearing of others which had not been touched since Prince Albert's death. Although King Edward continued to enjoy the same pastimes as he did as Prince of Wales, he enthusiastically carried out his new duties and responsibilities as a constitutional monarch, taking a great interest in the state papers to which he finally had full access. This early enthusiasm did not last long, and he soon discovered that he could not personally attend to every single small detail and reply to each of his letters, and soon relied on secretaries to carry out the work on his instructions. He was far more comfortable fulfilling his public engagements, traveling around the country laying foundation stones, visiting schools and hospitals, opening exhibitions at museums and galleries. During these occasions, as well as when carrying out more important political duties such as the state opening of Parliament and meetings of the Privy Council, the King proved an effective and eloquent speaker who did not need to refer to any notes. The King also took an interest in matters of defence policy, asking to be consulted about the promotion of senior officers while being a vital supporter of First Sea Lord Jackie Fisher's reforms to the Navy in the lead-up to the First World War. He was also keenly interested in healthcare and medicine, and proved a generous patron to hospitals, establishing King Edward's Hospital Fund for London in 1907, which continues to support hospitals in London to the present day. As it had been during his tenure as Prince of Wales, the King was particularly interested in matters of diplomacy and often received foreign representatives alone to communicate the position of his ministers or carried out instructions from the government when he travelled abroad to meet his royal cousins sitting on a variety of European thrones. The King was irritated that his suggestions for diplomatic appointments were often ignored by the government and tried to assert his constitutional right to be consulted on such matters. With few political friends, the King was often defeated in political fights against the government, prevailing only on minor issues. The King had a strained relationship with Conservative Prime Minister Arthur Balfour, who led the government between 1902 and 1905. The Liberal leader, Sir Henry Campbell Bannerman, who won the election in 1905, would enjoy better social relations with the King, but the political winds were blowing against the King in favour of parliamentary democracy. In spite of his warm friendship with the King, the Liberal government under Campbell Bannerman and later Herbert Asquith sought to weaken the constitutional role of the King and the House of Lords. After the end of the Second Boer War in 1902, which saw British imperial forces take control of South Africa at the cost of high casualties, Balfour proposed a royal commission to inquire into the conduct of war. The King was vehemently opposed, recognising the damage a public inquiry would do to the reputation of the British Army and Empire, but the Prime Minister insisted that the commission must go ahead. In another instance, the King was opposed to the appointment of native Indians to the Viceroy's Executive Council when the Indian lawyer and Advocate General of Bengal, Satyendra Prasanna Sinha, was invited to join the body in 1909. The King believed that the appointment would threaten British rule in India and strengthen calls for more Indians to join the body, making the observation that the appointment of a Hindu to the council may prompt Indian Muslims to demand one of their own on the body. One of the most bitter fights between the King and Balfour was over the proposed award of the Order of the Garter, the most senior British order of knighthood, to the Shah of Persia. The Balfour government persuaded the Shah to make a visit to Britain by promising him the Garter, but the King objected to the award on the basis that it was a Christian order, even though Muslim rulers such as the Shah's father and the Ottoman Sultan had both been previously admitted to the order by Queen Victoria. When the Foreign Secretary, Lord Lansdowne, claimed to have the King's approval for a variation of the order to be created for non-Christians and sent him a proposed design, the King exploded in fury, displaying a violent burst of temper which he had been prone to since his childhood. The incident would have forced the Foreign Secretary to resign if Balfour hadn't backed Lansdowne and threatened to make it a resignation issue for the whole government. Faced with cabinet unity and accepting his constitutional limits, the King gave way and reluctantly bestowed the honour upon the Shah on the condition that this would be the last time the Garter was awarded to a non-Christian, though 5 years later he would agree to confer it upon the Emperor of Japan. In spite of his increased duties and responsibilities as King, Edward VII continued to enjoy himself with amusements as he had done throughout his life. His annual routine was regulated not only by ceremonial events such as the state opening of Parliament at the beginning of the year, but also the horse racing at Ascot in June alongside other race meetings, and the Cowes Regatta off the Isle of Wight in August. He enjoyed being in the country during the summer for the hunting season, going up to Balmoral in October before spending his birthday and Christmas in Sandringham. Guests at Sandringham would often remark of his extraordinary appetite, beginning with platefuls of bacon, eggs, chicken and haddock for breakfast, followed by a heavy lunch at 2:30 in the afternoon, a selection of cakes and snacks for tea, and dinner at 8:30 in the evening, typically a 12-course meal during which the king would consume dozens of oysters and enjoy such rich dishes as pheasant stuffed with truffles, frog's legs, and other dishes inspired by the French culinary tradition that he was so fond of. King Edward continued to enjoy his holidays abroad, spending several months each year in his beloved France. During these trips, he would travel incognito as the Duke of Lancaster or Earl of Chester, but this did not prevent him from being followed by French police detectives who left detailed reports of his visits to the famous Parisian beauties of the day, as well as his calls on establishments of lesser repute. The king's disguise was hardly necessary, as almost everyone in Paris knew who he was and paid him his due respects, and he would be annoyed at those who didn't discover his true identity. Edward also enjoyed spending time cruising the Mediterranean along the French Riviera, although in later life he preferred the quieter Atlantic coast. The king made sure to take annual trips to Biarritz in March, when his mistress, Mrs. Alice Keppel, was staying down the road. A Scottish aristocratic lady, 27 years his junior, whom he first met as Prince of Wales in 1898, Keppel became a close confidant and remained the king's mistress for the rest of his life. Owing to his amiable personality and his generosity, as well as his interest in foreign affairs, the king relished his diplomatic role. And, in spite of his indiscretions as Prince of Wales, his contemporaries believed that his presence on the European stage helped to preserve peace on the continent during a decade of increased political tensions. European diplomats supposed that it was the king, rather than his prime minister or foreign secretary, who ran Britain's foreign policy, a belief which may have contributed to the frosty relations between the king and Balfour's foreign secretary, Lord Lansdowne. Although Edward recognised his constitutional limits, he was insistent on receiving regular briefings on foreign policy from his ministers. The king's frequent foreign visits were interpreted as a response to the proactive diplomacy conducted by Kaiser Wilhelm II of Germany, the son of Edward's older sister Victoria, who had briefly been Empress of Germany during the brief reign of her husband, Kaiser Friedrich III. Wilhelm also travelled across Europe in an effort to enhance the prestige of the German Empire and strengthen its navy, which, in turn, threatened to destabilise Britain's economic domination, which was guaranteed by Britain's Royal Navy. It was this desire to counter the Kaiser's European diplomacy which set the stage for another confrontation between the king and the Balfour government. In April 1903, during a visit to Italy, the king intended to pay a visit to the Pope in Rome, whom the Kaiser had already met twice. As Prince of Wales, he had also called on the Vatican on each of the three occasions he visited Rome. Balfour's government was not keen on the visit, concerned that it would inflame Protestant opinion in Britain, but upon receiving word from the king that he was reluctant to snub the 93-year-old pontiff, the government eventually gave the king permission to make an informal private visit. After further diplomatic negotiations with the King of Italy, whose relations with the papacy had never been particularly friendly, on the 28th of April, the king and the Pope enjoyed a cordial meeting, during which the latter went out of his way not to embarrass the British sovereign. The following month, the king made a visit to France in an attempt to smooth relations between the two countries, which had been under pressure in recent years following the so-called Fashoda incident in 1898, where a detachment of French troops in the Sudan had been confronted by a much larger British force under the command of General Herbert Kitchener. This sparked a war scare, which eventually forced the French to retreat. Although Balfour was reluctant to allow the trip to go ahead, the government believed that the king's long-standing popularity in France would avoid any serious mishaps. In the aftermath of the Fashoda incident and in light of French sympathies towards Britain's enemies during the Boer War, Edward boycotted France for a couple of years, but decided it was finally time to set differences aside. Unlike his regular visits to France, which took place in a personal capacity, Edward was making this visit in his full royal dignity. The visit began poorly when the king and President Loubet received a cold reception as their carriage drove down the Champs-Élysées. But the king's cordial remarks that evening, which were reported in the press, encouraged a more positive reception from the Parisian crowd the following day, and henceforth his public appearances were met with sustained cheering. The king's visit to France, followed by President Loubet's return visit to England in July, created the conditions for the Entente Cordiale between Britain and France, signed in 1904. The Anglo-French Entente also gave Britain the opportunity to improve diplomatic relations with Russia, which had signed an alliance with France in the 1890s. As Prince of Wales, the King had made several visits to Russia, including in 1881 for the funeral of the assassinated Tsar Alexander II, and in 1894 for the funeral of his son and successor Alexander III, the husband of Alexandra's sister. However, for half a century, Anglo-Russian interests had clashed in Central Asia, and when Russia and Japan went to war in 1904 over control of the Korean Peninsula, both the British government and public supported the Japanese cause and welcomed Russia's humiliating defeat in 1905. The tensions over the war prevented the king from making a visit to Russia in 1906, but in 1907, an Anglo-Russian Entente had been signed, which helped to settle long-standing differences by defining their mutual spheres of influence in Asia. The signing of the Entente allowed the king to meet Tsar Nicholas II at Reval, modern-day Tallinn, in 1908, where he struck a warm relationship with the Russian ruler, despite raising the controversial subject of the prosecution of Jews in the Russian Empire. In 1909, Tsar Nicholas and his family were invited to England to attend the Cowes Regatta, further enhancing the goodwill between the two empires. Despite his close family connections with the Prussian royal family, which became the German imperial family after the unification of Germany in 1871, King Edward had never been a friend of Germany, especially after Prussia's expansionist wars against his wife's native Denmark in 1864 and against his beloved France in 1870 and 71. Bitterly opposed to the policies of Kaiser Wilhelm I and his Chancellor Otto von Bismarck, as Prince of Wales, he had hoped that the accession of his liberal brother-in-law, Friedrich III, would prove an opportunity to improve Anglo-German relations. However, by the time he had become Kaiser upon his father's death in March 1888, Friedrich was already dying of throat cancer, and lasted a mere 3 months on the throne before being succeeded by his more conservative son, Wilhelm II. Edward did not take any steps to disguise his disdain for his nephew, and the feeling was mutual. During the 1890s, he was irritated at the German Emperor's tendency to crash the Cowes Regatta, bringing with him the fastest yachts and exhibiting the newest ships of the German Imperial Navy, as if issuing a challenge to British naval supremacy. The Kaiser had been at his grandmother, Queen Victoria's, bedside when she died in 1901, and his genuine demonstration of grief following her death won him plaudits in England, and he spoke of a formidable Anglo-German alliance which would dominate the European continent and the high seas. Although the British and German governments entered negotiations for such an alliance, further meetings between King and Kaiser went poorly, and the British government withdrew from the talks in 1902. Relations between uncle and nephew reached rock bottom in 1905, when the Kaiser made a bombastic speech in Morocco, setting out Germany's grand imperial ambitions in the North African state. As part of the Entente, Britain had recognized Morocco as France's sphere of influence, and King Edward threw his diplomatic weight behind the French, infuriating the Kaiser, who believed the British monarch was intent on destroying the German Empire. The two men traded insults, with the Kaiser especially keen on spreading tales of his uncle's private life. Efforts to mend relations proved counterproductive when, during a visit to Britain in 1908, the Kaiser made insulting remarks about the French and Russians, claiming that Germany was Britain's only friend during the Boer War, and told the New York Times in an interview that he expected Britain and Germany to go to war, and that Germany would triumph. During a state visit to Germany in February 1909, the King was afflicted by breathing difficulties and had briefly lost consciousness as his lifelong smoking habit finally caught up with him. The King's health was not helped by a constitutional crisis that summer, with the Liberal government led by Prime Minister Herbert Asquith and his Chancellor of the Exchequer, David Lloyd George, who introduced a budget raising taxes on the wealthier part of society in order to fund a package of social welfare schemes. Although these initiatives infuriated the British aristocracy, the King hoped to persuade the House of Lords to vote through the budget passed by the Commons in accordance with a precedent that was two centuries old. When the Lords nevertheless voted against the budget, the Liberals approached the King with a plan to create hundreds of Liberal Lords to give the government the votes to pass its legislation. The King believed this would call into question the impartiality of the Crown. Even after the Liberals called a general election for January 1910 and retained their majority. The following month, Asquith withdrew the pledge to pack the House of Lords, but the impasse over the budget was only resolved following the King's death, when the Lords gave up its opposition. During his annual trip to Biarritz in March 1910, King Edward suffered from acute bronchitis and collapsed from chest pains, prompting him to stay in the French port until the end of April. He remained seriously ill upon his return to England on the 27th of April, but continued to carry out his political engagements, and despite suffering several heart attacks on the 5th of May, he vowed to continue with his work, vowing to carry on with his duties until the end. Just before midnight, on the 6th of May, King Edward VII died at his Sandringham estate at the age of 68, succeeded by his son, who took the throne as King George V. On the 20th of May, the funeral of King Edward, nicknamed the Uncle of Europe, brought together nine European monarchs, including the German Kaiser, the kings of Belgium, Bulgaria, Denmark, Greece, Norway, Portugal, and Spain, in addition to King George V. In hindsight, the demise of Edward VII marked the end of an era, as 4 years later, the world would be engulfed in the First World War. Over the course of his 68 years, Britain retained its position as the global superpower, but the era also saw gradual changes in the underlying geopolitical dynamics which would shape the course of the 20th century. At home, Edward fought a determined but losing battle against the trend towards popular participation in the political process at the expense of the monarchy. As Prince of Wales, and later as King, Edward witnessed with apprehension the wars of German unification and the expansionist policy of his nephew Kaiser Wilhelm II. In response, he improved Britain's relations with France and Russia and helped to move public opinion behind these diplomatic partnerships. At his death, Edward was recognized as a peacemaker who helped Britain emerge from the diplomatic isolation of the Boer War, but the alliances he helped to foster also created the conditions for the terrible global conflict that was to follow. For all of Edward's fears of German expansionism, which would prove justified with the outbreak of the First World War, it was the United States, rather than Germany, which would eclipse Britain as the world's leading power in the decades following his death. What do you think of Edward VII? Was he a great statesman whose charisma helped to boost the popularity of the monarchy among the British public, and whose diplomacy likewise helped to improve public perceptions of Britain in continental Europe? Or was he indulgent and decadent with loose morals and an indolent lifestyle? Please, let us know in the comment section. And in the meantime, thank you very much for watching.
Did you know Microsoft has officially ended support for Windows 10? Upgrade to Windows 11 with an LG Gram laptop. Voted PC Mag's Reader's Choice Top Laptop Brand for 2025. Thin and ultra lightweight, the LG Gram keeps you productive anywhere. And Windows 11 gives you access to free security updates and ongoing feature upgrades. Visit lgusa.com/iHeart for great seasonal savings on LG Gram laptops with Windows 11. PC Mag Reader's Choice used with permission. All rights reserved.